I call the meeting of the February 11, 2025 meeting of the House Public Safety to order. Quorum is present. Before we begin our meeting, I want to remind everyone that the committee expects property quorum at all times. All dialogue goes through the chair. Signs are not allowed in the committee room. There will be no outburst or clapping. There is no standing or sitting in the walkways and aisles. If accommodations are needed, communicate with the sergeant staff. There will be consequences if there is a disruption. Thank you to the sergeant at arms staff who are present for the to help maintain a decorum in the committee room. Since this is the first meeting with all staff in attendance and members, we'll beginning with introductions. Please tell us about your district and communities you represent and your professional background. And then we'll go to staff afterwards. We'll start with members, and I believe is it Mr. Johnson on the far end?
My name is Representative Pete Johnson. Represent District 8A, which is the central and western portions of Duluth. For my background, I've been a professional firefighter for going on 23 years, 19 of those years in the city there, responding on the street to a lot of calls over that time. Also a union officer with our local, been doing that for 17 years, as well as a state officer with the State Firefighters Union and a service rep for our international. Background, I've got a master's degree in public leadership and public safety leadership and administration.
Hi, I'm Lucy Rehm. I represent 48B, which is all of Chanhassen, part of Chaska, and a little bit of Excelsior. I'm a mom of three. I served on the city council in Chanhassen prior to being elected to the state legislative rep position. I also taught overseas for a number of years. I taught English as a foreign language, and I'm happy to be here.
I'm Kayla Berg. I represent 55B, which is the heart of Burnsville. I've been a union flight attendant for 22 years, also have 22 years of union leadership under my belt, and I'm a mom of two amazing young men.
Representative Breon Curran, I represent District 36B, which is the White Bear Lake area. I am a former 911 operator from my community and a former deputy in Chisago County. My greater background lies in disability services for 20 years. Happy to be back on the committee.
Hi, everyone. I'm Sandra Feist. These things don't come down. Okay. My district is 39B, which is parts of New Brighton, Columbia Heights, and St. Anthony. I am an immigration attorney, and since we're talking about kids, I have two human kids. I have an English bulldog and a sulcata African land tortoise. That is very large. Nice to be here.
Good afternoon, Representative Emma Greenman. I represent 63B, which is the southernmost part of Minneapolis. I am a voting rights lawyer, but relevant to this committee, I got my start as a public defender when I was first starting out my legal career.
Hi, I'm Representative Kelly Moeller, District 40A, Northern Ramsey County Suburbs. I've been a prosecutor, felony level appeals for over 20 years with a specific passion for gender-based violence. Also was the executive director of the Minnesota Alliance on Crime, the General Crime Victim Coalition.
I'm Representative Paul Navani. I represent 30B, which is Elk River, now then parts of Otsego and parts of Oak Grove. 33 years in law enforcement, retired in 2020.
I'm Jeff Witte. I represent Lakeville. I was a Burnsville police officer for 27 years, and I worked at the local Ace Hardware after retiring. Currently, I'm a game day Minnesota Twins security, and I see a lot of my fellow reps there, so go Twins.
Representative Matt Bliss, District 2B, North Central Minnesota, basically Leech Lake Reservation, White Earth Reservation. Small business owner, 32 years in the IT field.
Representative Bedell Duran, prior military and law enforcement, got a master's degree in criminal justice leadership. And I represent 2A, which is Bemidji all the way up to the Canadian border, Lake of the Woods, and then northern part of Clearwater County.
Representative Walter Hudson, District 30A, Northeastern Wright County. Background on a variety of sectors, including commercial public safety, where I've been a supervisor, a manager, and this is my second term.
My name is Erica Schwartz. I represent Nicola County, which is 18A. I'm a small business owner. I'm a mother of three, and I'm also a freshman.
Elliot Engen, District 36A, which is Lionel Lakes, Centerville, Circle Pines, White Bear Township, and North Oaks. Have a background in prosecution assistance and court operations in Ramsey and Hennepin counties.
Aaron Rapinski, District 26A, which is essentially Winona County. I'm a former firefighter, EMT rescue diver, and currently a master captain, merchant mariner, credentialed U.S. Coast Guard boat captain.
Good afternoon. I'm Representative Bobby Harder. I represent House District 17B, which is most of Carver County and parts of Carver and McLeod. As far as my background, I served two terms as a county commissioner, and when I'm not here serving as a state representative, I am agriculture crop farmer. Thank you, and I enjoy being here. Thank you.
I'm Terry Steer, District 22B, which is Le Sueur County, a little bit of Scott County, including Belle Plaine, Blue Earth County, and Rice County. I have 23 years law enforcement experience.
Chair Novotny, members, good afternoon. Dave Pinto, representing the southwest part of St. Paul. I work outside the legislature as a felony level prosecutor with the Ramsey County Attorney's Office. And like Representative Moeller, I have a background particularly in gender-based violence, starting off with domestic assault cases and then handling sexual exploitation, sex trafficking cases. And I now charge a wide variety of those cases. I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. Brad Tadke, 54A Shakopee. Looking forward to a great committee. Thanks, everybody.
Hi, I'm Athena Hollins. I represent District 66B, which is the northern neighborhoods of St. Paul. I've been a lawyer for 14 years, and I'm also a mom and just like a cool person. So,
thank you, members. And now we'll go on to staff. We've both got both partisan and nonpartisan staff. JR?
My name is J.R. Swanson. I've been with the House for about 5 years, and I'm a research consultant with the Republican Caucus.
Zach Meinertz, DFL Research.
Ellen McDaniel, Committee Administrator for the DFL Caucus.
Ben Johnson, House Research Analyst.
Mary McNamara, Committee Legislative Assistant.
John Holdquist, Committee Administrator for the House Republican Caucus for both the Public Safety Committee and the Veterans Committee. I've been with the House since 2011.
Mr. Chair, Jeff Diebel with House Research.
John Walls, House Fiscal Staff.
All right, members, there is a roster of members and staff in your packet. Committee rules are also in your packet. The rules were emailed to all House members and staff last Friday, and I should just say that these staff rules or the committee rules were the same rules that Chair Moeller had last year in session. The only thing that I believe would change was the submission times for amendments.
Mr. Chair, thanks. And it's my understanding that if we return to a tie situation again, that we had worked on some rules in the interim that just would reflect co-chairing.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
All right, the first and only bill on the agenda today is House File 7. This is my bill, and I'm hoping we can get through the bill within the regular committee time, but if we don't, we do have this room reserved until 6:30 tonight. Vice Chair Witte, would you please assume that?
Chair Novotny, do you want to move the House File 7 is recommended to pass and be re-referred to Judiciary Committee?
That is my motion.
Chair Novotny, please begin your testimony.
House File 7 is a priorities bill from the House Republican Caucus in the public safety areas. The themes of this bill are helping law enforcement make our communities safer from criminals, keeping violent and dangerous offenders off the street, holding the criminal justice system accountable. There are 12 different provisions that compromise this bill that come from the bills that House Republicans have authored. Many of them have been offered in previous biennium, but the majority has not given them a hearing. Law enforcement has requested some of these provisions. Other sections have been in response to heart-wrenching stories we continue to hear of violent criminals who are out on the street reoffending. Finally, there are some provisions in this bill that have come from the frustration the public has when it comes from the charging and sentencing practices by the criminal justice system. There's been a dramatic increase in carjackings and stolen motor vehicles in the past 5 years. Many of these crimes are committed by juveniles, some as young as 12 years old. Now, I say this because this was the previous script that I had from over a month ago. In the last weekend, if anyone watched, there was a violent carjacking that took place in the metro, Minneapolis. A woman was tackled. Her car was stolen from her. The individuals in that car that were eventually arrested through the work of the Minnesota State Patrol and other law enforcement agencies involved many juveniles, every one of which was known to the criminal justice system. I believe one was 11 years old. One had a warrant for attempted murder at 15 years of age. They use these stolen cars to commit more crimes and often bait police into chasing them, knowing they won't be prosecuted. There are provisions in this bill that law enforcement have requested to get a better handle on these crimes. They include an increased penalty for fleeing in a reckless manner, excessive speed, running red lights, stop signs, putting the public at a greater risk of serious injury or loss of life, making it a crime to be in a stolen vehicle. Under current law, police can only arrest the driver, but they know that everyone else in the car is aware that the car was stolen, and the passengers usually played an active role in stealing it. Authorizing law enforcement to place tracking devices on fleeing vehicles. The law was changed 2 years ago to allow law enforcement to put tracking device on a reported stolen vehicle. The law needs to be amended to allow placement of the tracking device on a vehicle when it is unoccupied as well as occupied. This bill does that. There are other safety concerns law enforcement and the public have expressed to us in the past few years. This bill seeks to address those concerns. It increases the penalty for blocking a freeway, a highway, transit, or a road leading to or from an airport. These are dangerous practices for the people involved, as well as for emergency vehicles that may not be able to get to a fire or a hospital when a person is in a life-threatening situation. It increases the penalty on people who conspire to trespass on or damage critical infrastructure such as pipelines, utility lines, and substations, including water and sewer lines. Peace officers have also been under assault, both figuratively as well as literally in recent years. It is one of the reasons police officers have been leaving the profession. This bill includes a penalty increase to a felony for assaulting a peace officer. Some of the violent crimes this bill addresses includes a mandatory minimum 10-year sentence for predators that engage in first-degree sex trafficking and predatory offender registration required for offenders who engage in criminal sexual conduct and receive a state sentence. The bill also corrects the 2024 Minnesota Supreme Court decision that requires a person to retreat if they have the ability to do so rather than using force to aid another person in resisting an individual. The provision authorizes someone to use force to aid another person and imposes no duty to retreat. In his dissent, Justice Paul Thiessen, a former Speaker of the House, wrote, Until now, the collective wisdom of judges nationwide over hundreds of years has never imposed a duty to retreat before making threats to deter an aggressor. Finally, this bill brings sunlight to the practice of our criminal justice partners, many of whom work hard every day to keep our community safe, but some of whom have a revolving door that spins criminals back out onto the street. This bill requires that there is greater public disclosure of who pays bills, the bail of someone out on to bail someone out of jail, a publicly searchable database for county attorney dismissals, a publicly searchable database for criminal sentencing reductions, and legislative approval for sentencing changes promulgated by the governor-appointed unselected sentencing guidelines commission. The provisions of this bill are not the only solutions the House Republicans have, but they present a cross-section of bills that will make our community safer.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. I believe you have a few testifiers that you want to come testify.
I do, and the first testifier will be Chief Deputy Under Sheriff Mike Martin of the Ramsey County Sheriff's Office. Mr. Martin is, I would describe as the subject matter expert when it comes to gang crime. I don't know of anyone else that can, he is a walking encyclopedia of juvenile crime adventures or activities. He's worked extensively in his previous life in the Minneapolis Police Department before coming to Ramsey County. And he is out working the street several times a week when he's not doing undersheriff duties. With that, I give you Undersheriff Mike Martin.
Thank you. And just a quick note, we'll have all testifiers speak before we take any questions from our committee members. And then when you come up to testify, can you please state your name for the record to begin your testimony? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Witte and members of the committee. I'm Mike Martin. I'm an undersheriff with the Ramsey County Sheriff's Office. I oversee the Apprehension and Regional Services Bureau, which includes the carjacking and auto theft unit and our violent crime enforcement team, our intel team, and our gun unit, which is a non-fatal shooting unit. Fatal shootings are handled separately. But shots fired and shootings where the victim doesn't die. I've been a police officer for, 35 years total, with a slight recess in the middle when I retired and then came back. I really want to talk about the fleeing provisions in the statute, in this bill. Our number one priority is always public safety. We want to keep the community safe, and we want to do that by hopefully avoiding pursuits. Pursuits have some inherent risk, and if we can avoid those, we prefer to. Obviously, we want to recover stolen vehicles as well for the victims and prevent further crimes, as Representative Novotny said. Oftentimes these vehicles are used to do robberies to commit robberies, assaults, and other crimes, thefts. Just this morning, Minneapolis had a series of thefts and robberies related to a stolen vehicle with juveniles in it. We assisted them with some information about that case. In 2022, you gave us the ability to put GPS trackers on fleeing stolen vehicles, which was a tremendous tool for us. That and some other things that we've done have helped us to achieve a dramatic decrease in Ramsey County of carjackings and auto thefts. 74%, I believe, was the last number I heard. And also credit to the county attorney's office for assisting us in those cases. However, one of the things that we've learned is oftentimes the people who steal the vehicles will get out of the vehicle temporarily, especially if they think the police are following them, go into a building or a business or a residence, and then come back out. And the provision in this bill that would allow us to place a GPS tracker on those unoccupied vehicles would allow us to sit back, wait for them to return to the vehicle, and apprehend the offenders, which is the best way we can to prevent further crime. The case that Representative Novotny mentioned from Friday night, where the juveniles fled and were apprehended, the State Patrol helicopter was up, tremendous asset for us. Watched the car when the individuals got out. They fled from the vehicle and they went into a garage about a half a block away. Here's an interesting side note to that. Once they got all the kids in custody and went back, the vehicle was gone. Had someone been able to place a tracker on the vehicle, they would have been able to find it pretty quickly, avoid a pursuit. If we know there's a tracker on the vehicle, we can hang back and just like when the helicopter's up and go to the area and wait till a safe time to take the suspects into custody. So those were the provisions in the bill that I wanted to address. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up is Shane Myrie, and on deck is Sheriff Brian Welk.
Chair and members, good afternoon. My name is Shane Myrie, and I'm the president of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, or MPPOA. Thank you for the opportunity to testify here on House File 7. At MPPOA, we represent the rank and file peace officer and public safety professionals across the state of Minnesota, and there are several provisions in House File 7 that are supported by our members. First, with regard to the proposed language in Section 8, updating the statute concerning fourth-degree assault against a peace officer. According to the VCA's posted law enforcement officers killed and assaulted, or LEOCA data, from 2021 to 2024, there are over 3,000 assaults, and over 1,400 of those were aggravated assaults. Now, this is, of course, of great concern to our members and their families, and we appreciate our elected officials engaging on this issue. And looking at how the bill is drafted, I would also consider an option of adding an aggravated sentence if an individual has a prior felony conviction of fourth-degree assault on a peace officer involving demonstrable bodily harm or the intentional throwing or transferring of bodily fluids onto the officer. In addition to all assaults on peace officers, I know our public safety officers in the corrections field are also dealing with being assaulted in the line of duty. So I would also consider the option of looking at fourth degree assault against a corrections officer statute with the same aggregating language if there's a prior felony conviction for a previous fourth degree assault against a corrections officer. Next, there are several provisions in the bill, sections 10, 11, 16, and 17, that we support because they take a comprehensive approach, including both criminal procedure modifications and Minnesota criminal code modifications for dealing with fleeing police in a motor vehicle. As was said by the undersheriff, fleeing suspects have created a public safety crisis on our roadways. They create dangerous and sometimes deadly consequences for the drivers, innocent victims, and law enforcement. When we talk about fleeing police in a motor vehicle, here are examples of five different scenarios that our members encounter on a street. First, a traffic stop where the vehicle occupant originally stops and then decides to flee from a stopped position. That could be the result of the warrant status of the driver or an occupant of the vehicle, or it could be if there's something in the vehicle that the driver or the occupants are worrying that the police officer might be gaining access to. Second would be an attempted traffic stop where the vehicle driver decides not to stop at all. Again, it would be probably for some of those same matters, warrant status of an occupant of the vehicle or something that may be in the vehicle or vehicle contents. Third would be a suspect actively fleeing the scene of a crime. Now, there are two dangerous and emerging trends that we are also seeing. Suspects steal a vehicle, engage in multiple criminal activities throughout a geographical area using the stolen vehicle, and then repeatedly flee from law enforcement when we try to stop them and eventually dump the vehicle. And lastly, at a predetermined meeting location distributed on social media, groups of individuals get together in vehicles with the intention of causing problems on the streets, essentially baiting law enforcement into pursuing them so they can flee. An example of this is a flyer that law enforcement came into contact with. I'm not going to get into the name of the organization or the date because we don't want to promote that, but it's essentially a flyer bringing everybody together, and the language used in the flyer is stay together until chased. So they're baiting law enforcement and they're predetermined setting these up. So with regard to the proposed language at Section 10, the current fleeing a police officer in a motor vehicle statute has a 3-year cap for the simple flee. And then after that, it's the tiered approach. If there's death, great bodily harm, or substantial bodily harm, there's subsequent years for sentencing based on those factors. So there's a gap between the two extremes. And our membership believes that adding language to cover actions that go beyond simple flee but don't result in death, GBH, or SBH is a good public policy decision for this committee. This would address fleeing situations where the fleeing vehicle leaves the roadway, drives on sidewalks, drives through city parks, or ends up driving the wrong way on a roadway into or against oncoming traffic. With regard to the proposed language at Section 11, creating a new criminal provision for illegal presence in a stolen motor vehicle, our members are currently dealing with stolen vehicles in joyriding, as was previously testified. Oftentimes, these vehicles are occupied by more than one individual. This language creates a progressive standard as it starts with misdemeanor and then a subsequent conviction is a gross misdemeanor. So hopefully with regard to juveniles or others that are involved in these auto thefts, after that misdemeanor conviction, they'll understand that it's a crime just to be in that stolen vehicle as well. With regard to the language in Section 16 and 17, removing the requirement that a reported stolen vehicle be occupied prior to law enforcement being able to apply that tracking device on the stolen vehicle, and creating an exception under 626A for an actively fleeing motor vehicle. Our members support these provisions for three reasons: safety, safety, and safety. If law enforcement is able to apply that mobile tracking device on a stolen vehicle while it's unoccupied, or if we're able to apply it on an actively fleeing motor vehicle, it creates time and space between law enforcement and the stolen fleeing vehicle. So an arrest operation can be planned, developed, and implemented at a time, place, and manner that's dictated by law enforcement personnel. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the time this afternoon.
Thank you. Next up is Sheriff Brian Welk. On deck is Jeff Potts.
Good afternoon. My name is Brian Welk. Chair, committee members, thank you for allowing me to testify today. I'm serving as the current sheriff of Cass County up in northern Minnesota. I'm here today to speak on behalf of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association to speak in support of several provisions, 8 to be exact, within House File Number 7. These provisions will enhance public safety, hold offenders accountable, and provide law enforcement with necessary tools to combat crime in our communities. The last testifiers you had were from the metro area, and we have unique situations up in rural Minnesota where we don't have air support. We often find stolen vehicles off in the road burnt, and people don't have the money to buy insurance, and now they're left without a vehicle. So the first thing, point is increased penalty for fleeing police in a reckless manner. Fleeing a police officer is becoming more and more common and more dangerous. The suspects involved in these incidents are increasingly younger and often repeat offenders. Fleeing from law enforcement in a reckless manner endangers not only officers but also innocent bystanders. The rise in high-speed pursuits has led to severe injuries and fatalities, creating an urgent need for stronger deterrence. Current penalties are insufficient to curb this dangerous behavior. By increasing the penalty, we reinforce the seriousness of these offenses and help prevent pursuits that put lives at risk, ensuring that individuals who make the decision to flee law enforcement face meaningful consequences. Next point I want to talk about is the authorization of the tracker device to place tracking devices on fleeing and stolen vehicles. Even when unoccupied, it is a common sense measure. This will allow law enforcement to recover stolen property more efficiently and track suspects safely, reducing the need for high-speed pursuits. This provision is a step forward in modern policing. Next point is criminalizing being in a stolen vehicle. Currently, individuals found in a stolen vehicle often evade accountability. Unless they are caught in the act of stealing the vehicle, establishing a specific offense for being in a stolen vehicle closes the loophole, making it easier to hold offenders responsible and deter auto theft. Next point on assaulting a police officer, making it a felony level. Assaults on peace officers has increased, and the lack of severe consequences emboldens offenders. Elevating this crime to a felony sends a strong message that violence against law enforcement will not be tolerated. Officers must be protected while they perform their duties to keep our community safe. Blocking, next point is blocking the critical roadways and increase the penalty on that. Blocking freeways, airports, or public transit not only disrupts essential transportation services, but also creates serious safety risks. Law enforcement must be able to respond effectively to these situations, and increased penalties will serve as a deterrent to those who are unlawfully obstructing public highways and infrastructure. Next is increased penalty for conspiracy to trespass and damage critical infrastructure. In my county, we have an international pipeline, Pipeline 3, that comes through both the middle of our county and then on the top northern part. And we dealt a lot with the protesting, and we had some damage that occurred, and they faced little to no consequences. So this is an important part that we saw firsthand in our part of the county, and it needs to be addressed, because if left unchecked, it has a big issue for bad things happening. Critical infrastructures, including power stations, water facilities, transportation hubs, are vital to public safety and economic stability. Intentional trespass and damage to these facilities pose severe risk, and stronger penalties will help prevent these threats before they escalate into serious incidents. The next point I want to bring up is the mandatory minimum sentence on first-degree sex trafficking. This also is something we're seeing an increase in all over the state and nationwide. Sex trafficking is a heinous crime that preys on the vulnerable. Establishing a mandatory minimum for first-degree sex trafficking ensures that traffickers face significant consequences. This measure will help dismantle trafficking networks and provide justice for victims. Next point is a predatory offender registration for state criminal sexual conduct sentences. Individuals convicted of criminal sexual conduct should be required to register as a predatory offender, even if they receive a state sentence. This provision ensures that law enforcement and communities are aware of offenders who pose a risk, enhancing public safety and preventing future victimization. When we have a heinous event like something this occur, them are the first databases that we are looking for, people who have like offenses, and this would be helpful for something like this. In conclusion, House File Number 10
House File Number 7 contains key provisions that will improve law enforcement's ability to protect our communities, strengthening penalties for serious crimes, providing new investigative tools, and ensuring proper consequences for offenders will make Minnesota a safer place for all. On behalf of the Minnesota Sheriff's Department or Sheriff's Association, I urge your support for these measures. Thank you for your time today, Chair and committee members.
Thank you. Next up is Jeff Potts. On deck is David Zimmer.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Jeff Potts, Executive Director for the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, and I'm here today speaking on behalf of the roughly 300 police chiefs in Minnesota, representing agencies small, medium, large in the metropolitan area as well as those in rural areas. The previous three testifiers covered a lot of the material and aspects of the bill. I'll keep my comments pretty brief, and these are items within this bill that specifically align with the legislative priorities of the Minnesota Chiefs Association. I'll start with sections 3 and 6. These are two what I'll call reporting requirements. These require section 3 require their provision that would require a publicly searchable database for courts to report sentences that are stayed by the court. We, over the last 3 or 4 years, as an association, have advocated for more reporting, more transparency. As you all know, there have been a number of provisions over the last 4 or 5 years requiring law enforcement to report data that we had not previously been required to report. And I guess I can sit here today and say, I think it has helped. I think it has helped us build trust and certainly added transparency in communities across the state. I think we are here today advocating for some additional reporting requirements, which we think will lead to more transparency and perhaps more trust and confidence in the criminal justice system. Subdivision 3 is one of those, again, requiring judges essentially to report sentences that are stayed in a publicly searchable database, as well as Section 6 requiring county attorneys to report on felony cases that were dismissed. We're not judging them or trying to take away any prosecutorial discretion. However, we do think that having that data available so that members of the law enforcement community and members of the community can see kind of what that looks like and draw their own conclusions. Moving on, Section 8. Addresses the assaults on police officers. This is a real, alarming area and an area of concern for law enforcement. 2019, there were 461 assaults on police officers in Minnesota. The last year that we have data from the BCA, which is 2023, there are 1,206. It's about a 61% increase. And so we do agree that this provision is needed. That's a 61% increase in and really specifically dealing with physical assaults on police officers. Moving on to two provisions that address fleeing. Just to give you, again, some statistics, in 2023, there were 2,262 reports of fleeing or pursuits here in Minnesota. This provision, I think, is addressing an area that we've tried to work on for a few years, which is really trying to look at the area of fleeing, and like many crimes, the severity and the penalties go up as the conduct is more deadly or more dangerous. And this does kind of carve out a new kind of category of pursuit. I think it was referred to earlier by one of the testifiers that the first offense is a felony. I think it was referred to as simple fleeing, and then the next one involves great bodily harm or death. This one's in the middle, which really is an area where the violators are running red lights, disobeying stop signs, and probably the most dangerous aspect of a pursuit is when they swerve into oncoming traffic. So when they do things like that, those pursuits are incredibly dangerous, and oftentimes agencies are disengaging in those, but nonetheless, the conduct is far more dangerous than the first level or element of fleeing. And so we agree with that provision that that carves that out and creates a stiffer penalty. But probably equally, if not more importantly, we agree with Section 12, the ability to deploy mobile tracking devices when vehicles flee. And the reason why I think this is needed and very important is as agencies continue to kind of assess the risk and reward of whether or not they continue engage in that pursuit or not, the ability to use technology like this type of a device would really allow them to kind of back off. And when the police officers back off, it's pretty common that the speed of that pursuit almost instantly decreases. By being able to use this type of technology, they can still follow or track where the vehicle goes. And hopefully recover the vehicle and those responsible for either stealing it or at least driving it when it was fleeing. But currently this piece of technology, as it's been determined in some counties, is not permissible. We think this is really a clarification to the statute that was passed a few years ago, and so that part is very important to us. We support many elements of the bill. I want to thank the author, Representative Novotny, for taking the time to meet with us over the last year or so to really try to work on a bill that will help public safety. And again, I want to thank the committee for allowing me to testify here today. Thank you.
Thank you. Up next is David Zimmer. On deck is Nate Reitz.
Afternoon, Vice Chair Witte and committee members. My name is David Zimmer. I currently serve as the Public Safety Policy Fellow with Center of the American Experiment. It's a position I've held for the past 3 years following a 33-year career in local law enforcement in Hennepin County. I appear today in support of House File 7 for two reasons. First, it provides much needed improvement in access to and transparency of criminal justice system data. Data that is imperative to the proper evaluation of our criminal justice system outcomes and to the development of sound public safety policy. It also aligns with the goal of ensuring our criminal justice system is a consequential system and not one of failed second, third, and fourth chances. The term accountability has quietly slipped into our criminal justice vocabulary, but accountability does not equate to being consequential. The revolving door of justice has damaged public safety in Minnesota, and House File 7 stands as a solid first step towards repairing that damage. Specific to criminal justice system data, House File 7 would create a publicly searchable database of sentencing data and charging and dismissal data by county attorneys. This would apply sunlight to some of the more troubling outcomes in our system and allow researchers the ability to provide more timely and pertinent information to policymakers. Public access to this data would focus more timely attention on some of the more egregious failures in our system. Failures such as the 42% downward departure rate our judges are currently applying to sentences calling for a prison commitment, the 71% of cases charged involving the use of a firearm that don't end up with the mandatory minimum sentences as directed by statute, the unknown percentage of charges dropped or mandatory minimum sentences avoided, which are currently unavailable in a publicly accessible format. Specific to increasing consequences, two important crimes are addressed in House File 7 that I believe would have a significant impact on reining in the lawlessness that we have witnessed in Minnesota in recent years: assaults on police officers and fleeing police in a motor vehicle. Per our Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, over the past 4 years, there have been nearly 5,000 assaults on our peace officers in Minnesota, resulting in 2,106 injuries. 1,436 of these assaults were considered aggravated assaults. 240 of these assaults involved a firearm used against our police officers. 40 of these assaults were considered ambushes, and 5 tragically involved the murders of our peace officers and 1 tactical medic. Comparing officer assault data from 2017 to the present reveals a staggering 190% increase in assaults on our police officers, a 475% increase in assaults using a firearm, a 164% increase in injuries to officers. And while it seems strange that this is the lowest, it's still a 100% increase in ambush assaults on officers. Of course, these increases include the tragic ambush murders of 5 Minnesota first responders in the past 2 years. Expanding that search regionally to include just the eastern borders of North and South Dakota, the northern border of Iowa, and the western border of Wisconsin, I found that in just 18 months between January 23 and June 2024, no fewer than 27 law enforcement officers in our region and 1 tactical medic were injured by gunfire directed at them. 9 of those officers and 1 tactical medic were killed in those shootings. This is unprecedented, and the tragic loss of those officers has been devastating to their loved ones, their agencies, and the communities they served. Transitioning to the proposed amendment addressing fleeing police in a motor vehicle, I'd start by noting that we are at a disadvantage of knowing the true number of fleeing incidents, as we track only those fleeing incidents where law enforcement engages in a pursuit. I'd submit those numbers do not reflect the true magnitude of the growing number of fleeing incidents that endanger us all. Using pursuit data, again from our Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, it's clear that the current consequences facing offenders serve as a poor deterrent. In the past 4 years, Minnesota law enforcement has had to initiate 11,596 pursuits. That's nearly 8 per day across the state. Minnesota law enforcement has had to, they've terminated 42% of those out of a concern for public safety. But the actions of offenders made the remaining 58% of those pursuits necessary. These fleeing incidents that turned into pursuits resulted in 857 crashes, over 1,000 injuries to citizens and officers, and tragically 20 deaths. Anecdotally, my son is a current sheriff's deputy working patrol in the metro area. He has personally pursued multiple young teens and young adults in stolen vehicles, arrested them only to have them casually fall asleep in the back of his squad car, completely unconcerned with the consequences facing them. In Minneapolis and throughout the metro, it is now common for young teens in stolen vehicles to incite chases and then to ram pursuing squad cars. Tying this data issue together, my research indicates the fleeing police charge is often the first to get tossed in a plea agreement, though once again, we lack solid data on this information. I'd like to note that our neighboring legislators in North Dakota are currently debating those 2 exact issues in a Senate bill, Bill 2128. Their amendment, or they propose amending their statutes to deal with assaults on police officers and fleeing police in a motor vehicle. Currently, assaults on police officers and fleeing police in a motor vehicle offenses in North Dakota are already felonies. However, the North Dakota legislature is strongly considering applying a mandatory minimum 30-day imprisonment for each offense to run consecutive to any sentence for an underlying offense. In summary, the lack of consequences to these crimes serve to desensitize the lawlessness and disorder that we all see. Efforts such as House File 7, which attempt to strengthen consequences, are much needed and have my full-throated support. Thank you.
Thank you. Up next is Nate Wrights, and up on deck is Addie Best.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Nate Wrights. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. So the 13 members of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission whom I work for, it is true they are not elected to the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, but four of them happen to be elected officials in their own right. Sometimes that's five, depending on whether our peace officer member is an elected sheriff. Also, it is also true that most of the members, 10 of the members, are either directly or indirectly appointed by the governor, but three of the members are appointed by the judicial branch. I'm interested in testifying today on Section 4 of House File 7, which has to do with how the sentencing guidelines are changed. When the Minnesota legislature created the first Sentencing Guidelines Commission in the nation in 1978, it made the commission's policy initiatives, including the promulgation of those very first sentencing guidelines, subject to legislative override. Legislative override means that the commission submits its proposed changes to the legislature at the beginning of session, and those changes take effect in August unless the legislature, by law, provides otherwise. Section 4 would replace this 47-year-old legislative override structure with a new legislative approval structure. Commission policy initiatives would not take effect unless the legislature by law affirmatively enacts the proposal. The Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission, my commission, has not taken a position on Section 4, so I'm not here today to testify for or against it. I'm simply here to illustrate at least one advantage that the current legislative override structure has over the proposed legislative approval structure by telling a story that some of you are part of and will remember vividly, and some this will be new to you. And the story is the Drug Sentencing Reform Act of 2016. Between 1989 and 1998, through a series of legislative and guidelines changes, the severity of Minnesota's criminal drug penalties grew significantly. By the 2000s and into the 2010s, consensus had emerged that Minnesota's drug sentencing structure had problems, and the legislature directed various studies and a working group, but no consensus developed around a particular solution to this problem that everyone recognized. So the years went by without the needed drug sentencing reform. Finally, in 2015, my commission, the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission, developed a proposed set of sentencing guidelines changes related to drug sentencing and submitted this proposal to the legislature in January 2016. Although the legislature did not entirely agree with the commission's proposal, and the commission doesn't have access to as many levers as the legislature does, the proposal forced legislators and criminal justice stakeholders, some of whom are in this room, to meet and finally find consensus solutions to the well-known problems within Minnesota's drug sentencing structure, consensus that, as I say, had eluded policymakers since nearly the turn of the century. The result was the Drug Sentencing Reform Act of 2016, a broadly bipartisan, well-received law that squarely addressed these long-standing issues in drug sentencing. My point here is this. It is highly doubtful that the Drug Sentencing Reform Act would have been enacted in 2016 without the Commission's imperfect drug sentencing proposal in January of that year. More likely, 2016 would have been just another year of admiring the problem. Legislators and stakeholders were forced to come to consensus in 2016 because without legislative action, the Commission's imperfect and limited solution would have taken effect under the legislative override structure. Mr. Chair, it is true that the legislative override structure is a significant delegation of legislative power to the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission, but that delegation is not without limits. The legislature has the entire session to pass legislation to block misguided policy proposals. And as we saw in 2016, sometimes it takes the legislative override structure to break up a longstanding policy stalemate. Thank you.
Thank you. Up next is Addie Best. On deck is Amy Brawler. Can you please state your name for the record, and you can go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Addie Best. I live in northern Minnesota near Grand Rapids. Many might not be aware that there were nearly 1,000 arrests in our quiet rural communities in northern Minnesota during the protests surrounding the Enbridge Line 3 pipeline replacement project that concluded at the end of 2021. The individuals involved in these arrests came mostly from out of state, often coming with the intention of disrupting and damaging our local infrastructure. This was not a random act, it was organized. These out-of-state participants were supported by a network of organizers who had a clear plan in mind. Some of these organizers even stood on Minnesota Capitol grounds and publicly encouraged others to come to Minnesota to make their viewpoint heard in a very forceful manner. Overnight, domestic terrorists began to flock to Minnesota in early 2017 and beyond, often trying to outdo the last illegal direct action to achieve greater social media reach. Quiet northern Minnesota communities reeled back from these extremists and relied on their law enforcement to remove the problem from our communities. Our law enforcement are community members in northern Minnesota. But some of these same protest organizers had previously been involved in events like the 2016 and 17 Standing Rock protests in North Dakota, where they refined their tactics and they were open about wanting to bring the same level of disruption to Minnesota. For some, these actions may have been driven by financial motives, as these kinds of protests can lead to significant fundraising and media attention. The tactics used were not only disrespectful and disruptive, but also dangerous. I watched live streams where individuals threw harmful objects, including human waste, at our law enforcement. There were also instances where dangerous roadblocks were set up, including freezing a piano to the street in the dark. They would always make sure to have a sacrificial, arrestable protester shackled to the objects, often dangerously placing their arm inside a sleeping dragon pipe to make removal more complex. There was little regard for the safety of their volunteers, many suffering in mental crisis, and the organizers would swiftly have their new recruits using their bodies to block a public street. They might be suspended over a street on a 20-foot tripod, a 40-foot bipod, shackled to an overturned vehicle, facing suffocation deep within a pipe, or quickly chained to a turning semi-truck, all while risking exposure to the elements. These elaborate setups were completed under the cover of night, further increasing the chances of a vehicle failing to identify them and stop in time. These direct actions and other monkey-wrenching sabotage put our communities and first responders in grave danger, all in the name of stopping a technology update to refresh an existing pipeline. Some protesters used harsh and hateful language, calling local residents, workers, and law enforcement derogatory names. The rhetoric became increasingly hostile, and it was clear that the intent was to create chaos and division. Many of these individuals were not from our community. They had prior aggravating offenses and did not seem to care about the safety and well-being of our neighbors. It's understandable that after a few years of this nonstop hostility towards locals just going about their daily lives, as well as frequent radical disruptions to their peace and safety, many community members are still exhibiting symptoms of PTSD following exposure to these combat-like tactics. In one notable instance, a group of four individuals managed to shut off a pipeline near my childhood home. They made terrorist threats to the company, forcing them to shut down operations of their own pipeline in order to prevent greater potential harm to our community. These individuals didn't just affect a distant corporation, they impacted real people, my friends, my neighbor, my family. neighborhoods that rely on the safety and security of these vital systems. When it came time for these individuals to face legal accountability and consequences for their harm, the legal process didn't seem to address the full scope of their actions. I reached out to the county attorney, sharing information about one of the individuals involved, including a serious, extensive criminal history and ties to other radical extremist groups, but my concerns were completely unanswered. And leniency prevailed, in effect minimizing the offenses and charging the group for simply cutting off a padlock, raising questions about the level of accountability in these cases. These organizers are often surrounded by individuals with criminal repeat offender backgrounds, and they continue to bring this kind of disruption to our communities, but they never provide them an exit strategy. Many individuals in this protest pipeline remain in the state, either facing charges, lacking funds to leave, losing their home due to extended absence, or refusing to return to other states where they face charges from a similar criminal history.
Annie, can I have you wrap it up? We got some other testifiers. Sure.
Many of these organizers have become financially successful while operating under the guise of nonprofit organizations, acquiring expensive homes and building wealth from the chaos that they help to create. These groups are not just acting on their own. They are highly organized and have a long history of stirring up unrest across various causes and states, organizing through a cause to rework tactics of Earth First, BLM, Antifa, and then training and channeling individuals to the front lines wherever needed. Stop Line 3, Stop PolyMet, in other states, Stop Line 5, Stop Cop City, Stop Eagle Line, Stop Mountain Valley, and the recent hostile George Floyd riots and Palestine actions that we've seen right in Minnesota. Each event serves to add fuel to the next, and it's clear that they are benefiting financially from stringing together the ongoing turmoil. Over the years, I've noticed that certain groups on social media have become very organized in their efforts to challenge local communities. They operate as part of what they call a resistance movement, often using social media.
Thank you, Eddie. I'm going to have to wrap it up. Thank you. We're going to have the next testifier.
Okay. Thank you.
Next up is Amy Brayler and on deck, Rich Neumeister.
Good afternoon. My name is Amy Brawlier. I'm a constituent of Paul's from Elk River, so that's mainly why I'm here today. I speak to you on stolen Dakota land in so-called Minnesota. I'm here to speak against House File 7, particularly Section 7 and 12. I'm here today as a European, white, cisgendered female, auntie, elder, retiree from the 4th Judicial District, which is Hennepin County, as well as a former elementary teacher in Columbia Heights. Like many privileged Minnesotans, I enjoy a family cabin up north at the lake, and love for water brought me here today to talking with you. I speak to Sections 7 and 12, critical infrastructure, vicarious liability, and increasing the charge to a felony level for trespass and damaging a pipeline. This bill targets people like me who believe in the rights of nature and who protect water, also known as protest pipelines, pipelines that damage our land, waters, and creatures. On a side note, we continue to uncover and document damage left in northern Minnesota by Enbridge's Line 3 and 93. If you're interested, check out wadukawadamikwag.org, a local community scientist group, that means those who help beaver in Anishinaabe, in Ojibwe, and they're documenting the harm that has been left by Enbridge, a Canadian company, I might add. Used more broadly, this bill could be used to silence dissent of any kind, and that's why I'm here today. That would be an undermining of democracy, making this truly a felony free speech bill. As a Minnesotan who cares for all who live here and those who will come seven generations from now, I am against this bill. Please do not allow it to pass.
Thank you, Amy. Next up is Rich Neumeister, and on deck, Will Cooley.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. I am addressing sections 16 and 17. 3 years ago, with the amendment dealing with tracking warrants, the reason why that language was put in is that because law enforcement had a new tech toy where they would be able to shoot out a dart that would go on a fleeing car. Even though many people felt there was no need to change the language, the reason why is that because in our state law, which I helped write 35 years ago, 626A, 35, 36, and 37, there's a criminal penalty for putting on a tracking device without a warrant. Now, in exigent circumstances, when a police officer does it, they don't get the penalty. But the law enforcement lobbying group still wanted that section in law. Mr. Chairman, as your colleague, Chair Mueller, will be co-chair in the future, will share with you, that was a hard fight, and there was compromise, because one of the dynamics was that they were allowing to wear, when the dart was not to be used, but if a car was just reported stolen, you could place a tracker on it. So because of abuse and situations, and where, from my discussions with many officers, they like to get as much information they can, 24 hours was put in, as you can tell, if you look at that language, and then you can only install it when it's basically with someone in it, with particularly with the new technology. But now, with this change of law, you will be setting up, I believe, for abuse, unwarranted surveillance, other than just to recover the car and to arrest the people. My testimony is very detailed on that. And so, if there are the votes to get rid of that language, that which I think is a guardrail, there needs to be robust documentation in the record, affidavits, why they couldn't get a search warrant, why they had to place it. And even there are issues that come into play. What's the difference between if a stolen car, again, is reported in a license plate reader, which is now hooked up, which many law enforcement now have, oh, that car on the driveway is stolen. Is that going to allow a law enforcement officer to put a device on there in dread of night and then follow it for 24 hours? So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think there are some big issues that need to happen here. And why we're continuing this debate is that because we don't need to, because exigent circumstances do allow. Now, if you want to place tracking devices on a car that's reported stolen, no one in it, and there's no exigent circumstances, which is which the change in law will allow, I have some concerns. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my testimony is very detailed. And also, if it goes forward, I think as recommended to pass with no changes, I think in the next stop there needs to be a lot of documentation placed. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and thank you.
Thank you. Next up, Will Cooley.
Vice Chair Witte, members of the committee, my name is Will Cooley. I'm the policy director of the Minnesota Justice Research Center. I'm here to testify on HF7, but more broadly on rebalancing our criminal justice system away from excess punishment to prevention. HF7 endorses longer sentences and mandatory minimums, expensive, reactive measures that do little to deter crime. Meanwhile, we are underfunding and understaffing the most important thing law enforcement can do to prevent crime, solving violent crimes. Successfully solving violent crimes sends a message that criminal behavior will not be tolerated, which deters future offenses, provides a sense of justice for victims, reduces the urge to retaliate, and builds public trust in law enforcement agencies. Unfortunately, this crucial aspect of effective law enforcement is not working as it should. Two examples. The award-winning Star Tribune examination of more than 1,000 sexual assault cases revealed a neglect to interview witnesses, collect crucial evidence, or conduct criminal background checks on suspects. Many cases were never even assigned an investigator. Likewise, a Minnesota Reformer article reported that about 78% of 879 shootings in Minneapolis between 2018 and 2020 did not result in any arrests or charges. Two more recent examples. There are 12 investigators working all the homicides and non-fatal shootings in Minneapolis. Non-fatal shootings become a low priority and are not being adequately investigated. In contrast, Boston has up to 38 detectives working homicides. This effort and emphasis on solving shootings matters. In 2024, Boston had 24 homicides, Minneapolis had 76. Another example, the Full Stop gas station on Logan and Lowry. Anyone who drove past there this summer and fall knew there would be trouble. At MNJRC, we were fielding calls from the neighborhood asking us to do something about the problems. This location needed officers skilled in the proven methods of hotspot and problem-oriented policing, but Minneapolis is badly understaffed. Sure enough, in late November, a 23-year-old man was murdered in broad daylight at that gas station. This committee is split down the middle, which is an excellent opportunity to come together on something on which we all agree. The best way law enforcement can prevent violent crime is to enhance the certainty of being caught. In 2022, only 57% of violent crimes reported to law enforcement were solved. This is also a matter of racial justice, because when violent crimes go unsolved, it disproportionately affects historically disadvantaged communities. The state has a finite amount of resources, and we can redirect those funds away from excessively long sentences and mandatory minimums and towards investing in highly trained investigators and police officers engaged in problem-oriented policing. These officers, with our support, will be key to a safer future for all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you. That ends all our testifiers. There are a couple amendments. The first amendment is the A2. Chair Novotny, I believe the A2 is in an author's amendment.
That is my amendment.
Discussion on the A2 amendment.
Can you describe it?
I'm sorry. Chair Novotny, can you present the amendment?
Thank you, Chair Whitty. The A2 amendment requires that the offenders who receive a stay of adjudication for one of the criminal sexual conduct offenses in this bill and are currently on supervision must register as a predatory offender. The offender's supervision agent must notify them of the requirement to notify to register. If the offender doesn't have a supervision agent, the BCA must notify the offender and the local law enforcement where the offender lives. The offender must register as a predatory offender within 30 days of receiving notice of the requirement. That is the second, the A2 amendment. I will go on to just say that there is a standalone bill that goes along with this. They did have personal involvement in a couple of cases when I was working where the plea and the work to plead guilty to the crime was a big motivator of them that they don't want to register. And we think that that is a strong motivator of people, and it is also provides a big safety back stop that we need. When someone goes missing, it's important to know who that is. There was one particular case I was involved in involving a missing little girl. There was a large effort, all hands on deck. BCA, FBI was involved, and getting to everyone that lived within the area, unfortunately, it was a campground where many register offenders were living already. But there were many that we found out through after action analysis of people that had previous cases but were allowed and didn't have that registered status because of the stay. So that is my bill, Representative Whitty.
Thank you. Now on to discussion on the A2 amendment, Lead Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Novotny, have you received a fiscal note for this amendment?
No, a fiscal note for House File 7 and this amendment have been requested.
Lead Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And have you spoken with any of the probation or corrections agents who would have to do the notification or the BCA if the person doesn't have is no longer under court jurisdiction as to what this would entail for them?
No.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to recommend a no vote. We can talk about this bill. I believe it's an individual standalone bill that we're having again, and it sounds like this amendment will be brought again as well. So I have more to say on it, but in the interest of time, I'm just going to recommend a no vote.
Thank you. Any other discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay.
Nay.
Oh. Motion carries, and the A2 amendment is adopted. There's also an amendment coded House File 7, A3. Who will be offering the amendment?
Mr. Chair, the A3 is my amendment, and I will be withdrawing it.
The A3 amendment has been withdrawn. Are there any other questions for the bill author or any other testifiers?
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, before we start, I think a lot of our members are going to have questions about this, and I know you had mentioned we have room until 6:30. I know a number of our members are on another committee that's meeting, I believe, at 5 o'clock. And so, you know, I know the testifiers weren't given a time limit. This is our first opportunity to talk about quite a massive bill that has a lot of provisions in it. We have a lot of questions. We were planning on being on time today, and so just wondering if we don't finish, if we can roll this over till tomorrow.
No, we're going to try to continue through today.
Okay, Mr. Chair, but I'm not sure what's going to happen when our committee members have to go to another committee at 5 o'clock. And we were not given any notice that this could potentially roll over.
Are there any questions for the bill author or any testifiers? Representative Curran, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Just a few points here. I know we're limited on time with a bill that is comprised of several bills that we'll be going through later, too. You know, if we're talking about criminal consequences as a way of sort of deterring crime, deterring people from doing things that are damaging to other people, I would just point out that perhaps, you know, criminal consequences for people who stole land and put pipelines through it, maybe we should have had consequences for that. Criminal consequences for the people who bulldoze St. Paul neighborhoods for the convenience of people who live in suburbia. Maybe we could have done something about that. I understand that there's an increase in fleeing police, but I think what we're not talking about is people have increasingly fled police because they're increasingly more afraid. So my question then is, what are we doing to help people be less afraid of police so that they are less inclined to run away? I don't know that, you know, giving people, you know, sort of threats of more jail time is going to work when they're afraid. I don't think that lends to building trust with community. So I would like to see us do something where we work in a space where we're actually doing something about the real fear that people have of police officers that I would hope that you know, we could continue working on. I have a number of concerns with privacy and arrest data, bail data, case dismissals, and I can hold that if we're going to have another hearing on that. But, you know, I expect we'll talk about data privacy and judiciary as well. But I will say with the, I know the A3 had been withdrawn, but if we did enact a shoot first statute, then I might have less concerns about the privacy, given that those shoot first charges would probably be included in those reports. And I think that's something that we would all like to see. Thank you.
And just so we know, as we're discussing this, we're just discussing, we'll be on the limited to the provisions in House File 7 that have been presented today. So, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I have a bunch of questions here. So one, just maybe a couple process questions to start, and my lead can stop me if she doesn't want me to go to these places, but I'm a little bit confused because several of the provisions are in bills that we'll be hearing tomorrow. Would the chair, do we not ask questions about those? I'm just trying to figure out about kind of giving them an airing now versus they're coming up tomorrow. That would be one advantage, I will say, of hearing the, of having the bill be voted on tomorrow. But if the chair, either you, Mr. Vice Chair, or the chair can just sort of help me understand it regarding those provisions.
Yeah, I think those questions would be good for tomorrow after we hear those bills.
Okay.
And I think on the interest of time, that would be a good way to go about it.
Thank you. So, Mr. Chair, does that mean we'll be voting on provisions that we will not be asking questions about today?
So we are going to discuss, and right now we will at the end take a vote. So I would say that if you have some questions that will help you on your vote, you should answer or have them answered today.
Mr. Chair, so do we? So we should ask questions about the provisions
in
House File 7?
Okay. Yes, you can.
Okay, good. And that includes, and I think it's like maybe a total of, I think if you look at the Senate bills, it's like 12 different bills. So we'll just, we should be asking questions about those now because we'll be voting on that today, it sounds like, Mr. Chair.
That's correct, Representative Pinnell.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And then another question. Where is the bill going after this, Mr. Chair? Or what's the motion?
Yes, it's going to judiciary next.
Okay. And will the, would it come back to this committee? Because many of these provisions would come out of the budget for this committee. I know we were, there's not a fiscal note yet. We expect it would come back to this committee.
Yes.
Mr. Chair. Right. Thank you so much. And then I'll ask just a series of questions. I've got a lot of concerns about a number of provisions of the bill, but first I want to ask about a couple of things that I think maybe don't change existing law. So I'm a little confused. So Section 11 of the bill is the one about being found in a motor vehicle. And Chair Novotny, I'm confused because the misdemeanor crime of this seems like it's actually narrower and harder to prove than the existing crime of tampering in a motor vehicle, which is 609546. And so I'm just trying to understand, this is lines 10.3 to 10.5, what are we getting if we pass those lines? What new are we getting that we don't have under existing law?
Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Whitty. We're looking for the misdemeanor crime of knowingly being in a motor vehicle and the gross misdemeanor enhancement if it was previous conviction. This is another tool in the box for law enforcement. We see repeated cases every day of kids going out and joyriding and piling in. We want to give law enforcement the tools that they have asked for to help make the situation better and to stop crime.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Novotny. I guess so, Chair Novotny, 609546, current law, 609546 clause 2, makes it a misdemeanor crime to, quote, enter into or on a motor vehicle without the owner's permission. I'm not sure what would meet your new crime that wouldn't be satisfied in that. And as a charging attorney, I don't know what additional, I don't charge misdemeanors, I should say, except for a few cases, mostly felonies, but I'm just trying to understand what is a circumstance that would apply 10.3 to 10.5 that wouldn't apply under current law, 609546 of Vision 2.
We will, this is a bill, as I said, was requested by law enforcement, and the language was from law enforcement. If you agree that it should be a misdemeanor or gross misdemeanor to be in a motor vehicle that is stolen, then I would thank you for your support on this bill.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Chair Novotny, I guess my concern is just we want to be really careful about adding additional language if we already have language that applies, because then that's where things start. I've heard some concerns expressed about courts. That's where courts can start doing some weird things because they'll have to give effect to this language that is different than the existing language. I don't quite know where all that goes. So to my mind, it's sort of some evidence about how this bill was constructed, and I have some concerns about that. Similarly, the Section 7 and 12, which we heard some testimony about, these are the ones sort of about aiding and abetting certain actions that folks may take. What are the circumstances where these new sections, paragraph B, where these would apply that our current accomplice liability, this is aiding and abetting concepts around for hundreds of years. What is the circumstances that we are not currently capturing in our current aiding and abetting law that your new provisions would apply to?
Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. this would apply to the organizers, that we feel we needed better language. And it was, once again, a request from law enforcement to have more applicable laws that we could go after the people that caused this dangerous situation to occur. Now, I'd like to point out that nothing in this law prohibits some of these protests, peaceful protests, if you want to call them that. What we don't want is to encourage people to stand on freeways where the speeds are very high, and to block people from having no means of escaping. This is especially true on the freeways, but it's also in transit and surrounding airports where people come and go. So this is a request that we've developed over time, and we've had these requests come forward, and I think that they are enhancements that will make Minnesota safer. Once again, holding people that organize them, these were a response to what we've seen. We had the testimony about what happened during Enbridge. We saw what happened previously in the North Dakota protest, and these are bills that are in response to those situations.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so thank you, Chair Navani. I guess maybe I'll just end this section with this point that, again, hundreds of years of law that's been developed that basically says that if you aren't the one who does the crime, but you aid or abet that, and there's a lot of law relating to that, you are held just as liable as the person who did the crime. We have existing law about that. What concerns me here is that either this language is, once again, just repeating existing law, or it is blowing up and expanding in, I think, some really dangerous ways, hundreds of years of jurisprudence that, again, holds people accountable when they don't actually do the crime, but they aid the crime. So either of those things seemed really problematic to me in those sections as well. I do have a number of points and questions about the provisions coming up tomorrow. I'm a little bit concerned in the interest of time of making sure that my colleagues get a chance to bring up. I'll just note, so I was leading our state's work for several years in prosecuting and addressing the issue of sexual exploitation, sex trafficking of young people. We've talked about this before, Mr. Chair. I actually was the person who put together and charged, and then with a colleague tried the case resulting in the longest sentences for sex trafficking in state history. I will say that the provisions relating to trafficking and sexual violence in this, I think, do not work. I guess I'll leave it at that. We'll have more of a conversation tomorrow, apparently, and are highly problematic. They bring in some people in their ambit that I think it does not make any sense. And again, we'll talk further about this tomorrow. I will also note that I know we don't have a fiscal note yet, and you said it's going to come back. But I would say the taxpayers of Minnesota would be spending a lot of money on some things that does not make a lot of sense. Again, we'll talk further about this tomorrow. So I will be very glad no vote on this bill. I think there's a number of extremely concerning provisions, in addition to provisions that won't actually do anything. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Whitty.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Navani, I had some questions about sections 16 and 17 relating to warrantless searches of vehicles. And my first question is relating to the issue raised by Mr. Neumeister about sort of that intersection of our privacy rights under the Constitution and our home. I have a weird garage where the guy who owned the house before me was like a car nut, and so he created like a cement slab in our backyard so he could park cars there. So if there's a car parked in my fenced-in backyard, would law enforcement be able to conduct a warrantless search and put a tracking device on a car in my backyard in my home?
Chair Navani.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Feist, I'm sure the gentleman prefers to think of himself as a car enthusiast as opposed to a car nut. Can you point out the line that you're referring to that would authorize a tracking device on a stolen vehicle? That's what the unwarrantless search, which line it's referring to?
I'm referring to line 12.29, which takes out the restriction that we had included in the law that we passed last term that allowed law enforcement to use that sort of projectile tracking device on a
stolen vehicle that was in motion to address the issue of car chases.
4.21?
No, 12.29. Oh. Sorry. So this basically just says that an empty vehicle can have a tracking device placed on it. And my concern is that what if that empty vehicle is in a home where we have additional constitutional protections from warrantless searches?
Chair Novotny?
Shoot me that line again. 12.29.
Mm-hmm.
Chair Witte and Representative Feist, if the vehicle is stolen and a device is placed on, I don't understand the premise of your question.
Chair or Representative Feist, sir.
Thank you. So the objective, if I understand correctly, of Section 16 is to expand scenarios where we can conduct warrantless searches on stolen vehicles by placing these tracking devices. And the version that we passed last term were vehicles in which somebody was in those vehicles and had the possibility or were at that moment fleeing law enforcement. And so what we're doing at line 12.29 is eliminating the requirement that that vehicle be occupied. And so if there is a stolen vehicle in my home, my question is, why can't law enforcement get a warrant? And why should they be entitled to conduct a warrantless search potentially in my home, like on my home property?
I think that could only be described as, thank you, I'm sorry, Chair. That could only be described as hyperbole. The situation that was described by Under Sheriff Martin is much more reflective of the situation that we want to be able to solve. That vehicle, the single officer finds that vehicle after a pursuit. They place that on that as they go and search for the suspects that fled so someone doesn't get into it again. So I think if you need clarifications about the situations that we are referring to when this would be useful, that is exactly the situation that I envisioned when we came up with the language in this bill. I didn't get a chance to respond to Representative Pinto, and I'd like to go back to the aid and abet questions that Representative Pinto was speaking of. I'd like to point out to Representative Pinto that you talk about the history of aid and abet and that this is longstanding tradition. We just spent 4 years and a lot of committee time and a lot of state money reversing longstanding traditions and the way things were done with aid and abet. We just changed the statutes on aid and abet on murder. Okay? We just changed that. And by that, I mean we didn't change it. You changed it. That is the situation where, of course, that was aid and abet and that was changed. So are we trying to strengthen a law to make it so that people don't have to worry about a pipeline in their backyard being damaged by someone trying to be an eco-terrorist? Yes. Yes, we want to strengthen that. And do we want to make it apply and put language in this bill that specifically applies to that on aid and abet? Yes. Like I said, if you want to talk about aid and abet after what we just did in the last session on felony murder, that's exactly why we need these statutes and why it's important.
Representative Feist.
Thank you. Yeah, I guess if you don't mind, I will just, I believe that in the scenario that you're describing, Chair Novotny, that it would be very simple to get a warrant and that we created an exception based on new technology. And I think we should just be very careful about expanding exceptions to warrantless searches. I think the Fourth Amendment really matters, and we should be very cautious.
Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Witte. Representative Feist, I am as much of a libertarian probably as you are, and I feel that the constitutional protections are absolute. if you think that we can drop a warrant in the middle of the night with one car and situations that are beyond your control and thing, I don't know what you're talking about. having been involved in law enforcement at the end of my career when we were able to use computers and get computer science search warrants, you're still talking about something that's several hours to get a judge out of bed, get them to sign the warrant. We're talking about flowing, fast-moving situations where we don't have time and we don't have the manpower to take care of the situation. Mr. Cooley pointed out just how short Minneapolis is. This is a simple situation where you're trying to deal with a carload of, could be kids as young as 11, as described in these situations that you're trying to capture, and you don't have time to set up a perimeter. The first person there wants to go after the fleeing suspects. They throw a puck in the car as they're going away. As Under Sheriff Martin testified, by the time they got back, the vehicle was gone. That's exactly the situation that we want to avoid. Another situation, I think Mr. Neumeister was talking about, they've got the automatic license plate reader. They come by, they hit on a stolen vehicle. Maybe they don't have the personnel right then to surround it and get it into custody. So they shoot a puck out at that point, and they can sit back and marshal their resources and get the people there so that we can get the people in custody and maybe cut down on some of these crimes. If I felt for a second there was a situation where this would be abused, I'd be the first one to stand up with you. And if it does get abused, I will pledge to fix it with you. But if you need to get to the point where you're going to say that we're going to start shooting pucks out in people's backyards, I that's just beyond the argument. I don't even know how to respond to that.
Anything further, Representative Feist? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, my name was invoked. Can I?
Yes, I got you on the list.
Thank you, sir.
I do. Representative Greenman.
Thank you. And do you want to turn to Representative Pinto because it's responding to something? I'm going to bring up a different area of
Representative that, so Pinto. Go ahead.
And thank you, Chair. And I actually won't engage in back and forth in terms of comments, but just a question again, Mr. Chair. Can you name a circumstance under which current aiding and abetting law would not apply and your provision here would? I can think of circumstances, and I don't think they'd be justifiable. I'm curious as to what circumstance you would identify.
Off the top of my head, Chair Whitty, Representative Pinto, off the top of my head, I'm just so baffled by the line of questioning that it's hard for me to even understand. This doesn't take away from any of the other existing statutes. It only adds to it. It doesn't take away from anything else. It only adds and clarifies statutes that we have.
Okay, I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Chair Whitty. And I am looking at, I'm new to the committee, I'm looking at Section 8, and I am just wondering, sort of the difference between B and C and raising the penalties piece. I think everybody here would say that that violence against police officers, violence in general, assaults, is abhorrent. Is the goal, the sort of goal of this, deterrence? Or what's the goal in terms of raising the penalties on folks who assault police officers that are not inflicting bodily harm, if I'm reading that correctly?
Can you give me the line? I get a lot of echo up here.
I guess I'm trying to looking at 8.9 and the increasing of penalties for, and reading it with the C is already a felony, but it looks like what we're doing is raising penalties for folks who are convicted of assaulting a police officer, but when they're not inflicting bodily harm. And I'm just wondering, the purpose of this provision deterrence?
Chair Novotny.
Currently, the assault on the peace officer is a gross misdemeanor. We want to encourage that to a 2-year felony. What's the question?
Representative Greenman.
So the way I'm reading it with the provision below it, is that it is a felony if you either are inflicting assaults, if it inflicts bodily harm, or if you intentionally throw or otherwise. And I just, what I read this as is what we are doing is increasing the penalty of folks who assault a police officer but don't reach that level of inflicting demonstrable bodily harm. Is that right?
Chair Novotny.
We want to go to the felony for the assault, physical assault. I don't understand why this is hard to, the statute's there. So what are you looking for?
Representing agreement.
I guess what I'm going back to is the goals and sort of how we square. I think the goal here is deterrence, and I heard some testifiers talking about sending a message. And I'm wondering how you'd square that with the impact of President Trump's pardons of 100 or 1,500 people, some of whom were convicted of assaulting 174 police officers. And the reason it matters is the Fraternal Order of the Police raised those concerns in their, of their statement that it sends a dangerous message, quote, potentially emboldening others to commit similar acts of violence. So I think my question as we think about the purpose of this bill is if the goal is to deter people from attacking law enforcement, shouldn't you be more worried about and condemning those pardons and that dangerous message it sends? Because I think that it seems to me that there's a deterrence challenge we have, and that feels like something that got to square with. So I'm wondering what you think about that.
Chair Novotny.
The numbers of assaults against police officers and public safety officers in the last 5 years is well documented. I'd like to point out to you that right now below us, outside of room G23, is a display from the survivors of domestic abuse in the state of Minnesota in the last year. I'm not survivors, the victims of domestic assault in the last year. There are the names of the three public safety officers that were killed in Burnsville that displayed. I encourage everyone to go down and look at that. There's not a day that goes by that myself, and I'm sure Representative Witte and many other people in the room don't think of those individuals or Officer Mitchell. What I can control and what I can work on is the state of Minnesota. And what I would like to do is I'd like there to be less assaults on peace officers. And some good points were brought up about the need to maybe add public safety officers as a whole, including correctional and EMS, to the statute. So if I was to have anything that I would change in this bill, I would add an expansion from the definition of peace officer, and I would add public safety officers.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Novotny. And I agree with you, and I will go down. I actually didn't realize that I haven't been in the deep basement yet. But I guess what I agree with you on needing to recognize and needing to make sure that our law deters these attacks, these assaults, and when folks have died. 174 officers were assaulted. Six died. One was killed that day. So I guess what I'm asking is, as part of this conversation about deterring assaults on officers, will you condemn those pardons that released those folks who committed those crimes of the consequences, which we're talking about in these bills, is what the consequences are of those actions?
Thank you. Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I'm glad you mentioned the display downstairs because it corresponds with a concern I have. In Section 6, it says the report must include whether the victim, if any, supports the dismissal. And since this data would be publicly available, I'm concerned that this will put victims, especially victims of intimate partner violence, at risk of further harm or retaliation. Do you think this reporting requirement will keep those victims safe?
Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Whitty. And Representative Berg, if you have a suggestion that you'd like to offer that would protect domestic abuse victims, I'd accept that language and be happy to work with you on that.
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. I don't think I'm the only person in this room who is a survivor of sexual assault or within our collective caucuses, much less outside of this building. And I will tell you that there are survivors that do everything that they can in order to not be found. And when we have careless legislation like this, it puts us at great risk. And I'm not trying to offend, but women walk through this world in a different way than you do. You don't have fear at night in a dark parking lot. You don't have to constantly be aware of the tone of a conversation, especially with intimate partner abuse, being hyper aware, hyper vigilant of any mood change, any change in verbiage, anything that's going to escalate into something that you're going to have to protect yourself from. That is the world some of us live in, some of us have survived. So when we are talking about sections like this, we have to be extremely careful that we are centering the voices of victims and survivors versus what we just think is going to be a good idea. So my suggestion is delete the section. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Novotny, for bringing this bill forward. There seems to be a lot of confusion regarding a lot of the sections of this bill, so I just figured I'd kind of lay it out here for you. It's pretty rich that we're talking about how we're going to be hearing a lot of this stuff later, and we haven't been given the proper amount of time to vet it after we received a 1,400-page bill at the end of session that we were required to vote on that we'd never even seen. All right, so let's start with Section 2 here. This says that if you have a stay for being a child predator, public info is still to be made available. Pretty straightforward there. Section 7, don't damage property that isn't yours. And if you do it and others support you in that endeavor, whether via monetary or any form of actual aid in you committing that crime, there's going to be repercussions for that. Section 8 deals in assaults of law enforcement officers, which we've heard there's a 60% increase of them. So we're trying to curtail that via this. Let's take a look at Section 9, legislative approval. In 2021, the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission went away from and deviated from the legislature's approval for increased penalties for possessing or distributing child pornography. We're trying to say that we don't want to do that, that the legislative approval process make sure that stuff like that doesn't happen, which I think is pretty sensible. Section 10, knowingly fleeing a police officer, curtails that crime, of which we heard that there were 11,000 cases that resulted in over 20 deaths. We want to stop that. That's what this bill is doing here. You can no longer joyride in Section 11. I'll refer you to that section here. You can no longer joyride in a stolen vehicle as a passenger for a fun Friday night outing. There's going to be penalties for that, so we're trying to curtail that as well. Obstructing traffic in sections 14 and 15, you're no longer able to stop the daily movements of folks, potentially getting in the way of emergency personnel who are trying to get to a hospital or law enforcement who are trying to conduct their everyday duties. This bill is pretty darn straightforward, guys, and I'm getting a lot of interesting scoffs and weird looks about it, but we're doing the work of public safety that has not been done for the previous 2 years. We're going back on the pendulum and saying, no, there are repercussions for wrongdoings, and we're doing so unashamedly. So while we might get some goofy looks and lots of legalese that tries to make it seem as if what we're doing here is unserious, this is very serious work, and all of the victims that we are advocating for right now, I'm sure that they would agree with this. So would urge your support. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Without further discussion, I'm going to leave it to Lead Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have a couple of questions. First, is there a Senate companion?
It'll be introduced on Thursday.
We couldn't find one, but I don't.
It will be introduced on Thursday, I was told.
Okay.
And then my next question is, did you speak to any of the victim coalitions about this bill? The Violence Free Minnesota, Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, Minnesota Alliance on Crime, or either of the Indian Women's Victim Coalitions?
Not in this section, not in this session yet, no.
Thank you. I just heard somebody suggest that victims would agree with this. It sounds like they haven't even been consulted. I have many concerns about this bill. First, I'll say that it is extremely fiscally irresponsible. This bill doesn't have a fiscal note yet. It is going to have a massive cost. It creates a couple of databases. It has increased penalties for a number of different crimes. The predatory offender registration piece that's, we'll talk about it as a separate bill, is retroactive, and the amendment that we just added, that alone will have a massive cost. I think it's really irresponsible, especially in light of what we're potentially facing as cuts from the Trump administration and the congressional republics. You can laugh if you want, but that is a serious issue for our state. And so I think it is very fiscally irresponsible for us to be looking at a bill like this with such a massive cost and passing it out of the committee without knowing what that note is going to say yet. It does sound, at least, I was going to make a motion to have it stay here, although I did hear the chair say that it was going to come back here after judiciary, and I'm seeing some head nods to confirm that. So that's good. At least it will be coming back once we have that fiscal note. It's also really based on incorrect assumptions and incorrect data. Crime is actually down. In the 7-county metro area, reported decreases of 4.8% in motor vehicle theft, 8.5% in homicide, 11.8% burglary, 14% robbery in 2023. After reporting 605 carjackings in 2021 and 470 in 2022, the Minneapolis Police Department reported 271 in 2023, a 55% decrease in the city over 2 years. And we heard Ramsey County Sheriff's Department also say that they've had a decrease. And I know the St. Paul Police Department has been doing excellent work on this as well. We heard from Mr. Cooley that what matters when we're talking about decreasing crime is making sure that it is the probability of punishment, the actually being able to solve crimes, not increasing penalties. That has been shown by studies not to be a deterrent on crime. I'll also just note that there's incorrect information from the Center for the American Experiment. We have, I did go back and look at the data. We have increased felony sentences in Minnesota since 1981, a huge increase in the number of incarcerations for people, and 83% of cases that were sentenced in 2023 actually received the standard disposition. So the things that you're trying to do with respect to what you say is holding judges and county attorneys responsible, 83% of those cases receive the standard disposition. And I think all of those statistics are really important because we have been increasing penalties for years and for decades, and the increasing penalties isn't what has made Minnesota safer. We actually have to take a more comprehensive approach at public safety, which we have done over the last couple of years, and the numbers are showing that it is working. There are also a lot of assumptions made about the work that's done in the past. We actually did increase penalties for assaults on law enforcement. I think we can all agree that that's abhorrent and that's terrible. It is already a felony to commit assault that amounts to bodily harm. And people may not know, because it's in a statute, not in this bill, that bodily harm is defined as any physical pain or injury, illness, or any impairment of a physical condition. So a scratch to an officer is already a felony. That was the Eric Mattson bill. We supported that. He came and we applauded him in the gallery. I think our side was the only one that ended up voting for that bill. It was in a package. We also had the Domestic Violence and Firearms Task Force bill. I'm very much looking forward to the task force report, which will come in February, and that was really focused on the safety of law enforcement, and I know some law enforcement's leading that. I think some of them were maybe even testifiers today. With respect to the tracking, that was a bill I worked very closely with the Ramsey County Sheriff's Department on a few years, and we put protections in place, and though it's really shocking to me, rather, that some of those expansions are being requested today when we worked so hard to craft that bill a few years ago and bring all the stakeholders together. This bill is not victim-centered. I think we pointed out already that those groups haven't been haven't been talked to. The bail information was mentioned by Representative Berg and how that can be really dangerous to victims. The section about the prosecutor databases. You may have people, prosecutors, who dismiss a case because the victim becomes uncooperative. You want that to be public? That's not very safe or our victim forward. There are other situations where those cases might get dismissed for good reason. You might have a defendant who ends up cooperating with law enforcement. You might have a 5-year-old child of sexual abuse who a judge has ruled incompetent to testify. You might have a judge who found that a search was not correct under the Fourth Amendment, that a confession was improper under the Fifth Amendment. Those pieces of evidence are suppressed, and therefore the case has to be dismissed. There are many reasons why cases get dismissed. I am almost done. There are additional problems with the language of this bill. I have some concerns about the predatory offender registration. I'll save that for tomorrow. And then I'll just say it really ignores one of the main problems we're talking about when we're talking about increases in crime what's happening to our law enforcement officers, and that is easy access to firearms. This bill doesn't address that. That is something that is a major concern, and I'm really disappointed that this bill doesn't try to address that issue. And with that, I'm going to recommend a no vote.
Chair Novotny, any closing comments?
Thank you, Chair Witte. Lot to respond to there. Did not get a chance initially to respond to Representative Curran talking about that people are afraid. I would say if you think that the kids are fleeing in these stolen vehicles or cars that they're carjacked from because they're scared, you haven't seen them hanging outside their car as they whip donuts in the middle of an intersection. I don't think they're afraid. I would like them to be afraid. I would like them to have confidence that they're going to get caught and that the juvenile justice system will hold them accountable and that they receive some help to try to get them on their straight and narrow path. Representative Berg can't even respond to 6.5 of the longest years of my life were in investigations where I investigated numerous sexual assaults. These are cases that tear you up and stay with you and change your DNA. And I can't tell you how frustrating it is that you would question my dedication to victims overall, especially victims of criminal sexual conduct. And I say that because I'm looking right over my shoulder at my daughter who had to put up with me when I came home from some of these cases and how emotionally erect I would become working these cases. So you can throw all the allegations that you want at me. I will still continue to work for victims, especially criminal sexual assault victims. If there's something we need to do to protect them, I will do that. To call my bill irresponsible for the spending, what is responsible spending? What is the responsible amount to spend to try to prevent further victims? Mr. Cooley points out that we should just catch people and help them get better. We can't help them get better when they're not in custody. We can't help them when they're not getting some supervision. We look at system-wide of Hennepin County closing down juvenile facilities, Totem Town, places where they can get the help and maybe get straightened out. What's irresponsible? What's irresponsible is not getting to these kids to start with and giving them a chance to get back on the path before they get so far down that they can't get out. That's irresponsible. Nothing in my bill is anywhere near the outrage that I heard today. We're tweaking things at the request of law enforcement. There isn't a thing in this bill that I came up with by myself. It's years of cases, years of people coming to us saying, could you fix this? Could you fix that? Probably the most important thing we can do in this immediate future is this tracking. It's going on all the time. Placing of a tracking device on a fleeing vehicle is the most no-brainer for me. A fleeing vehicle is subject to forfeiture. You asked before, Representative Feist, about getting a warrant. You don't need a warrant to seize a vehicle that was involved in a fleeing. It's either a stolen vehicle, which it would go back to the owner, or if the person, if the owner of the vehicle is the driver or knew of the person fleeing in the motor vehicle, that vehicle is subject to forfeiture. We don't need a warrant for that. And it's one of the safest things that could be done to place that vehicle, that puck on the vehicle when you get a chance, you get close enough on a corner or something. I'm told they're limited to 20 miles an hour and 20 feet. It's very limited situations that could be done. But I've gone to tell people that their loved one has been hurt or injured in a fleeing vehicle. I don't want to do that. I don't want to go, or not that I would have to do it anymore, but I never wanted to be the one that would have to go tell someone that their loved one was injured during the course of a pursuit because they were trying to catch someone. These are all things that make sense, that were brought to us by victims, by law enforcement, by advocates. They all make sense to me. I request a green vote.
Would you like to renew your motion that House File 7 as amended be recommended pass and be re-referred to the Judiciary Committee? Chair Novotny.
Yes, I would.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
No.
Motion prevails and House File 7 as amended is passed to Judiciary Committee. Our next committee meeting will be on Wednesday, February 12th, 3 p.m. There being no other business before the committee day, the meeting is adjourned.